Hey everybody, on this episode of Strength Academy, Grayson and I are interviewing one of our athletes, Tyler Sanchez. He was top 20 at the American Open Finals last year, and he's competed at multiple national events, multiple American Open Finals, and he continues to be pushing towards those elite levels of weightlifting. And we just want to get a perspective from one of our own folks, and hopefully it's a good conversation. And without further ado, here we go.
Grayson here, joined by Mundo.
What's up, y'all?
And special guest today, Tyler Sanchez.
Hey, guys.
All right. So, Tyler, all eight of our audience want to know, when does this sport get easier? At what point in your career was it just easy?
It never gets easier. There's no point where it gets easier. You just accept that it's always going to be hard, and you keep moving forward.
All right, guys. So we just finished up a local lifting meet up in Santa Fe at the Miller Gym yesterday. We had 12 people from our club going up there, including Tyler, who did his first full meet in a Parametcons. So we've been kind of playing around with doing a lot of lifting in flat shoes coming off the American Open, because we've got a nice chunk of time for some off-season training before Nationals. What did you think, man? What was it like to try to lift heavy in not the best footwear for the occasion?
It's definitely a different experience when you're dealing with not training or not lifting in what you're used to. Leading up to it, I like to, after a big meet, go back and kind of reset all of my like muscles and stretch everything out. So getting to lift heavy in Metcons meant that I just sat a little lower in all my squats, but for the most part, I felt pretty stable.
Yeah, I thought all your lifts leading up to the weightlifting meet in training were really good, considering that you had, you know, ditched the lifters for a little bit, and they're pretty sharp, fast. Like, you didn't really lose anything by changing the heel height on your shoes, so your mobility's good, your strength is still there, and you went, what, 5 for 6?
5 for 6, yeah. 123. 2 snatch and a 159 clean and jerk.
Okay. So when you have to give up, like, I call them training crutches or training aids or whatever, do you have like a different mindset or approach to training as opposed to when you're wearing lifters, or is it all the same?
For the most part, it's the same. I just, there's new sticking points that you're not used to hitting. So when you switch over to not using something, you find those little sticking points. You're like, oh, I'm not used to sitting this far down in my squat. Okay, this is okay. Fight through it. All right, you're good.
Yeah, so is that something like that was inspired by Toshiki Yamamoto when he hit that snatch at Worlds? Or was this something you were doing before, even before then?
Right? I hadn't done a comp before in Metcon, so doing the comp was something that kind of was inspired by him. But definitely the past 3 or 4 times that we've done a big meet, coming off of it, it was just like, oh, I just want to wear my Metcons and kind of reset. And then one of the PTs I see, she also suggests take some time, squat in your regular shoes, make sure that you're still being mobile and you're not relying on your lifter so much.
Right.
Yeah, that was kind of a interesting thing that we've been playing with, like Tyler said, for the past, I don't know, 4 meets or so that we're kind of on that national level. And her argument is essentially that when you're lifting in your weightlifting shoes all the time, you're kind of always having those knees going a little bit further forward. So it inherently makes it a little bit more of a quad dominant squat, which is great when you need to stay more upright. But the problem that we were running into with Tyler was that he was starting to get some like IT band pain and some pain in his knees. And this was one of the things that was kind of recommended to us from her to try to just get that foot position in a little bit more of a natural position so that it kind of ends up training the back and the hamstrings a little bit more, just letting it be a more balanced squat than being so quad dominant. And I mean, you did, what, 210 for a triple in the back squat this morning, day after the meet?
210 for a triple?
Yeah, it's supposed to be 5, but I got tired.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can't see why. So how many national level meets have you done up to this point?
So we did, our first meet was universities in Ogden, and that was 3 years ago? 4 years now.
I think it was 2015.
So that would be the first, and then we did the American Open in Florida, the American Open in Anaheim, Nationals, and then this past American Open.
Okay. So after experiencing so many different levels of weightlifting, like which one's the most fun for you to compete at, and why?
Nationals is a blast. It feels more, there's just less people, so it just feels like less of, like, everyone's here to just do this, and they're ready to go. You don't have to worry about just so many people. Like, we were able to get in the training hall and train each day that we needed to and not worry about, like, oh, someone's not going to share, we're going to have to wait, like, 40 minutes to get on a platform to train. So I think that one was easily the most enjoyable, just because it was super competitive, but made it really small because of that, right, being so competitive.
And that was the one in Chicago?
That was Kansas.
Overton.
Overland Park.
Overland Park. That sounds.
I know what words are. I know. That's a
place. Yeah, it was in Kansas.
They had good barbecue, right, too. Couldn't go wrong.
Oh man, that must have been.
Yeah, that trip was really just all about eating as much barbecue as humanly possible.
Yeah. Memphis is kind of going to be the same way.
Oh yeah.
I have to eat a lot of barbecue.
But yeah, so we've been doing a little bit of different stuff with Tyler's off-season this go-around. Because he was struck by some inspiration by, is his name Ross Edgley?
Yeah, Ross Edgley.
So this is the crazy guy that swam all the way around Great Britain. He swam for 6 months, 6 hours on.
57 days, yeah. So he would, for the most part, swim 6 hours on, because that's when the tide was going the way he needed it to. Get off. Out of the water, onto the boat, rest, recover for 6 hours, get back in middle of the night because the tide is switched and he'd keep going. And he did that basically for 157 days straight.
That's got to be brutal. That's definitely got to be an exercise in like mental toughness and your ability to persist when things aren't really cheery and rosy.
Yeah, one of the biggest things that I took from it was like, he would, because he has a full, like, they documented the whole thing on YouTube, and he's done a bunch of podcasts now. But the biggest thing I took away from it is, like, he's like, I wanted to do this. Yeah, I could get up and I can complain because it's 3 a.m, my wetsuit's frozen, and I'm trying to shake off the ice, and I don't want to get in the cold water. But I want to do this. And that was the biggest thing that I took away is, like, yeah, I can complain during training, I can make jokes, but at the end of the day, like, I want to do this. Yeah. No one's pointing a gun to my head like, this is what I want to do. I got to put in the work.
So, like, I know that he would get like, certain spots that would chafe, like on his wetsuit, and he'd mm-hmm. have to deal with nagging things and injuries, stuff that you can relate to as a weightlifter. Is that kind of what you would drew you to his story as well?
Yeah, that like you push through. Like if it's not hurt, if it's not injured, you just keep going. That goes back to like playing soccer when I was younger. And coach me like, well, is it hurt? Like, is it a little painful or are you injured?
Right.
Because you can play through that little hurt. You can't play through injured.
Right.
So does your leg hurt a little bit or is it something you need to get looked at? And so just fighting through those little bits of like, oh, yeah, that kind of hurts, but I'm still good. Let's go.
So you're pretty good at determining when something just is the normal baseline level of this hurts. Or is injury, what's the line for you? How do you come to determine what is an actual thing that you need to get addressed and what's something that's just kind of a pain?
I think when it starts affecting me in my like daily life. So if my leg hurts while I'm squatting, well, yeah, I'm stressing the muscle to the point that it's hurting. But if I'm walking upstairs and my knee hurts, that's probably not good, and that's where I need to. So I think the line is when it starts affecting daily tasks that I'm doing.
Yeah.
I think that's actually a really good line. That's a good line to draw.
Yeah, that's a good way. It's a good way to approach anything, really. Like, if it's something that's messing with your everyday life, then you might need to have it evaluated, take a look at it.
So, kind of looking at that kind of change in the, you know, I want to do this mindset, did that kind of change the way that you... Because for a long time, when we first started out together, I was kind of just tricking you into doing weightlifting meets. Tyler was on like the competitive CrossFit team at the gym. And I was like, hey, you know how you can practice, you know, mental toughness for CrossFit competitions is come do this weightlifting meet. And he qualified for university nationals. I was like, hey, you want to go to Utah and lift with me at this meet? And I think that was the one that you got kind of hooked on there. But what goals did you have when you first started? Because I know that it was, you know, nationals and American Open, but has this, has getting, achieving those things and then having this change of outlook changed the way that you're setting goals for yourself now?
I think the goals are still the same. I just want to be the best that I can out there and keep improving, because competing is what I've done since I was a kid, and I don't ever want to stop competing. Like, I love it so much. So finding something that I'm good at and can continue to compete at for years to come is just, I think just keep improving is still the goal. I don't know. I mean, since I've made it to the meets that I had set goals for, like, oh, I want to go to nationals, and now that I've qualified and gone, qualified again and going in a few months, I think it's just keep improving. And I mean, I guess Pan Ams would be cool, because then Grayson has to jump out of an airplane. But
that is the agreement we struck.
Yeah. So what is the deal between you guys with that?
So essentially, I don't even like roller coasters. They stress me out. I don't have a whole lot of fun doing those sort of activities. And I think this was early on.
It was American Open in Orlando, I think, when we came across this, because we were talking about, I think there was a big slide there, and Grayson didn't want to go down the slide. And I was like, yeah, I'd love to go, like, jump out of an airplane. He was like, no, not me. I was like, well, what if I qualify for Pan Am? So you jump out of an airplane with me? And he was like, yeah, sure, I guess, if you qualify.
So right. that is now the agreement. So I'm now kind of wanting to go skydiving, just because I want Tyler to achieve those sort of things.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Do you set kind of goals for numbers that you want to hit, or do you just kind of aim at the do you set kind of process goals of, I'm just going to train really hard and get consistent, or do you have like a total that you're trying to reach at the moment?
A little bit of both. I like to have consistency goals, especially leading up to a meet, of like, I want to hit my opener so many times before I go out there. Like, before I'm even traveling to go to the American Open or Nationals, like, I want to know that I've hit my opener 50 times before the meet happens. And that's one thing that I feel confident with and love to do. And then just chasing that 300 total. I really want a 300 total, hopefully within this year. I said last year, but that didn't happen.
Yeah, you know how it goes.
But yeah, I think that hitting the opener, you know, some people kind of do that thing where they just always open up at 95%, or, you know, a weight that's like really struggling because they're trying to set up for that PR. And, you know, I think it's a definitely a different approach to be like, no, I need to open with something I can make on the minute for 8 reps. Because I think that's what we did with the opener from American Open, right? We did an six to eight minute EMOM with that. So we do a lot of EMOM training for you leading up into meets, just so that opener is just the easiest, least worrisome thing. And I think that's an important thing. I think that's been really valuable for building confidence in the meet and kind of giving you the confidence to make the kind of big jumps that you make. Because we've just started, you know, shying away from realizing that a 5 kilo jump on the clean and jerk, you can make a 7 kilo jump on the clean and jerk now. Like, you're at the meet this last weekend, Tyler's final warm-up attempt before opening up at 148 on the platform, he did 140, cleaned it, and just decided not to do the jerk because he's tired. So technically you made, what, the last jerk you did was 130 before 148?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a huge jump.
So how do you, because I know that a lot of the time that people feel the need to make small jumps is an issue with feeling confident with the weights, because it's more about just rehearsing and getting those things down. What do you do when you're lifting in competition to give yourself the confidence to do those kind of big jumps? Do you do a visualization, or do you just kind of do that kind of positive, cocky self-talk of like, I don't even need to jerk this? Like, how is it that you get yourself into a headspace where you can make those jumps?
I think it comes from training. I think I've just trained those jumps so much now that it's not, it doesn't come across when I'm in the back, like, oh, this is a really big jump. I'm just used to it. Like, I think our programming this, the past couple weeks, I've been doing for clean and jerks, it was like 60, 70, 75, 80 or something. But it, all of those jumps ended up being like 15 kilos every time. So I was already just jumping from like 115 to 130 and not getting to like do anything in between because that's just what was programmed.
Right.
And I think a lot of like the initial times that I was taking big jumps came from doing like CrossFit classes where they're like, you have 10 minutes to work up to this. And you're like, I don't, there's too much weight to do that. Like, I can't do that in 10 minutes. So it was just like, okay, well, if I'm working up to a heavy 3 back squat in 10 minutes, that means I got to put 45, okay, another 45, and you're just throwing weights on trying to get there in time and not miss out because you only have 10 minutes.
So you've been weightlifting for probably about 4 years then, roughly, since 2015, if that was your first, like, big meet. What would you tell yourself if you could go back and start... give yourself some tips. Like, what would you tell yourself as a new weightlifter? Like, things to watch out for, or like stuff you wish you would have knew as a new weightlifter.
I think just giving everything the time it deserves. Like, it's not all about the big lifts. Like, there's a bunch of accessories that I skipped out on a lot.
That
I probably should have done, and I'm regretting now. I don't think I pressed for like a year because I was just like, I hate presses. These are dumb. And oh, Grayson, I'll do that at home. I'll do that later. And I skipped presses. I probably skipped abs. Skipped a lot of the accessory stuff. And I think it would just be don't skip out on those things because they'll help you in the long run.
Okay. So be mindful of the accessory stuff.
Just finish the training. Like, it's all programmed for a reason. Right. You may not understand the reason why you're doing seesaw presses. They may make no sense in your head, but I mean, there's a reason that it's being done, and if you just follow along, you'll see it in the end.
That makes sense. So we were talking, so you were one of those people that was affected by the new rule for the 2019 IWF rule change about kicking the bar, and it's something that you kind of had in your weightlifting routine for quite a while. How is your adaptation to that new rule going?
It's going good. I didn't kick the bar once this meet. I just bumped it with my shin.
Is that going to be the new thing, is the shin bump?
Yeah, I mean, the start of the kicking the bar with my foot was comes from playing soccer for so many years. So you get a free kick and you go to set up and you just bump the ball with your foot and then you take your shot or take your kick. And that's where, like, so as soon as I started weightlifting, I would just tap the bar up, get myself set, and that was like the initiation of my setup. So now it's just like, okay, I'll bump it with my shin, especially at like going to Nationals or the American Open. Those platforms, they always have divots right where they're setting the bar, like that middle section, just from everyone dropping. And that's where the bar's loaded the whole time. However many sessions have gone through, like, that's the worst spot. So I usually, most of the time, I'm kicking the bar out of the divot because I don't like being in that little divot. So now I'll just be like, bump the bar out of the divot. Use my shin.
That makes sense. And I've seen that that up there on those stages too, is where they have one platform in particular that's made of like 4x4s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're like all stacked together and they're held together with like a gigantic screw, and then they bolt it together. But it doesn't always sit evenly. So I could see, that could definitely get annoying. All right, so.
Yeah, so we kind of covered a little bit of kind of training mentality and kind of how you get yourself used to those things. But what is your approach in training? Because in competitions, you're usually pretty focused. Your headphones on, doing your warm-up routine. But that is certainly not how you train. So how do you think about training? Like, what do you do to kind of try to make yourself want to be in the gym? Because it is hard, as we said at the start.
You just gotta make it fun. I mean, if you're not messing around trying to get your tape into the trash can for an hour, did you even go to the gym? I mean, we got a good group of people at our gym, and I mean, there's times where you do have to struggle alone and be there by yourself and get in your own headspace so you know how to compete. But there's other times where it's better to just have some people around, even if it's just, oh, we talked about what the weather was like for an hour while we trained and got ourselves distracted because the squats hurt so bad. It's just a helpful distraction some of the times.
Yeah, so do you think environment really makes a difference? Like,
oh yeah,
it has an effect on your training?
Yeah, there's times like if everyone in there's having a bad day or in a mood, it makes it harder to train, because then I'll get in a mood, and it's always better when everyone comes in and everyone, whether they had a good day or not, they're ready to go. They're ready to leave that all at the door and just enjoy themselves, because we do weightlifting because we want to do it and we love to do it. So if you're not having fun, why are you doing it?
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I totally agree.
So that kind of covers, you know, in competition and in training, but I know that some things that we've been working on kind of gradually over the years is managing stuff outside of the gym. So like so to get yourself from, I think that first meet where we qualified for universities, you did a 130 clean and jerk. And so what sort of lifestyle factor, like what sort of things have you had to change in your daily routine or your job or these sort of things to get to that level? Because I think a lot of times people neglect the stuff that you have to be doing outside of the gym. So what were the kind of the things that you had to kind of change in structure to be performing as well as you have been?
I think the biggest big help was when I did get a new job last year, is that my just schedule became more consistent, and just being able to keep everything simpler and more consistent has made it a lot easier. The job before that, when I was working like 60 hours a week and my days were always changing and I didn't know whether I was going to be there this long or that long, just consistency in your schedule makes it a lot easier. If you have a plan for the week and you can execute it, it makes it a lot easier. Helps you plan your meals, helps you make sure that you're recovering at the right time, get the right amount of sleep, just a good solid plan for each week and keeping it consistent.
So like, cause I know that you intentionally chose a job with less hours, right? So you're kind of training about the equivalent amount of time that you're working now. Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty close.
So I think that, you know, if, you know, your aspiration is that, you know, really shooting and reaching for being the best at weightlifting that you can be, sometimes that means that you do have to kind of put that on the front burner. And I think that since you've done that, it's really just made a big difference in your training, being able to say, no, well, you know what? This is the time that I can put my full energy and effort into this sport and not worrying about, you know, what, you know, job advancement stuff that you're doing, and taking that time to focus on weightlifting.
Yeah, it's an all or nothing for me at this point, where it's like, this is what I want to do. I'm giving it everything I got. Like, other people that are competing too are going to school, and that's their priority, and that's where their focus is. Their careers are coming ahead of them, and for me, it's, I mean, I'd be fine being a stay-at-home dad and just lifting weights all the time. That'd be cool with me.
But I think the results of your decisions shows too. The amount of time that you're able to train, the consistency that you train with, has carried really well over into your ability to compete well. And I'm not an advocate for saying anybody has to climb any kind of corporate ladder or anything like that, but if you're doing what you want to do and it's going, you know, in a direction that you want it to go, I'm all for it. And your ability to decide that this is important to you and to say, hey, this is something that I'm going to put a full amount of effort in. I'm not going to half-ass it. I'm going to give it everything I've got. It really has shown in your performances recently on the national stage and in the gym, and consistently. Like I said, even doing what, 310 for
210
for a triple is in Metcons is ridiculous. But like, not many people can say that they're willing to do that in exchange for, you know, chasing something that they really want to do. Mm-hmm. So I find that really admirable. But so do you have, what's one story that you would tell that just absolutely drives you crazy about being Grayson being your coach? Like something hilarious or something funny. So like if one thing sticks out in your mind about Grayson being your coach, like what would it be?
That's tough.
Is it tough because there's many of them?
There's a lot of stories.
Well, one that sticks out, I mean, right now then.
The first few interactions I had with Grayson was like, I had just got back from a back injury from doing like the 2013 Open, started going back to Black Box, and Grayson's like, hey, you're kind of strong. They're going to do this comp team tryout. You could do that. I was like, all right, cool. So I did the comp team tryout, made the comp team, started dying in CrossFit all the time. And I think we did Boxtoberfest, and like Boxtoberfest was rough for me. I couldn't eat before any of the workouts. I was so nervous just the whole time. And I was like, man, I guess I just need to compete more. Like, I've never been nervous like this. Like, all through my sports career, never had nerves like that. Right. And he's like, oh, well, hey, you could come do this weightlifting meet. I was like, all right, cool. He's like, yeah, it'll make you better at doing CrossFit and competing, and you won't get so nervous. It's like, oh, yeah, cool. Did the meet. He's like, oh, yeah. So the numbers you hit that he set me up to hit qualified me to go to university now. She's like, oh, yeah, a couple of us are going to universities. You can just come and do this meet. I was like, all right, cool. I guess we can do that meet. Yeah, I'll find the money. It'd be cool to travel. We finish that meet and start talking. He's like, well, your numbers aren't that far off from qualifying for the American Open. And if you cut weight, too, you can get down to here. It'd be a lot easier. And it just kept snowballing from there. All
right. So the theme is that secretly, Grayson is sneakily pushing you to be a better athlete and weightlifter.
He's gotten real good at it.
He's gotten good at it.
He's good at Tyler manipulation.
One of the memories that I have from that first trip out to Ogden is Tyler and I had we'd only interacted in the gym, and not even like that much, just a couple days a week, and then we had to share a bed in Ogden. And, it was just like the most, we were both just like, all right, just try not to roll over and punch someone in their sleep, or like end up laying on it. They're just like on opposite ends of the bed, just like, this is kind of awkward.
It was a really small bed, too. It wasn't like a queen-size bed. Yeah, it was a really tiny bed.
It's a full-size bed.
I just remember, just like, don't move. Okay. Oh, this is really uncomfortable. I woke up the next day, and I don't think my back's ever hurt from sleeping more than that night.
Yeah, that was a good trip. That was a good trip. I think you had to... Your session was delayed, so I think you did your final clean and jerk at like 10:45 at night.
No, that
was that Florida?
So, we got delayed because the group before us had to have the platform cleaned quite a few times, and then after that, we had to. I think there was like we're in the C session or D session, and the coaches were changing weights like they were in the A session, that like 13 changes went in, and we had a 30-minute technical stop, so we warmed up for snatch twice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
that was Orlando?
Yeah. I think you and Ben were in the back for that.
That's right. That's right. That was a mess. I remember that.
Because we didn't finish till like 11 o'clock. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really cool to see, even just from that meet to this last American Open, or you know, any AO series, where now they're so good at running those things that everything's on time with like triple the number of lifters. The meets. Yeah. So have you noticed an improvement in the quality of the meets?
Oh yeah, they've taken the sessions. I think they've taken the athletes in a session down, and have just done more sessions than they were doing before. Because I think we only went up to a D session for that American Open. We probably could have had an E. I think we had 20 lifters in my session. Like, it was way too many. And I think they've got it down to a solid, like, 12 to 15 for every session. Yeah. And it makes it go, everything stays on time now.
So, what would you say that the biggest challenge you had to overcome? Like, what was the thing that, like, what's a, like, hurdle that you have kind of clearly defined in your memory? Was there a particular sticking point or... what did you find to be like the hardest thing to overcome?
Just in weightlifting in general?
Or? Yeah, so just in your training over the last few years. Mm-hmm. What did you really struggle with when you were getting going?
I think I struggled with the fact that I was just doing weightlifting for a while. Like, that was a struggle because I came from CrossFit and I always felt like I needed to do more, and I felt like I was like losing. And then just started hitting plateaus as soon as the PR stopped coming, because I wasn't making any real gains anymore from just newbie gains. They were all gone. That it was just struggling through those plateaus. And I'm pretty sure I had a solid year with a lot of clarking. And then the final one that helped me like really reevaluate what I was doing was bombing out at AO in Anaheim. Because we just, that was where I basically took, like, okay, don't open where I'm not comfortable. Because I think I went out and I tried to open at like 153, which I probably hit a couple times in training, but it wasn't somewhere I should have been opening. I hadn't hit it enough to be like, oh yeah. Because at that point I was still thinking every time I go into a meet, I need to hit a PR.
Yeah.
And that was just the, I think that, all of that leading up, just the plateau into a bunch of clarking, and then that bomb out. After that, it was just like, okay, I have to lift this weight so many times before I can go out on the platform. And okay, I'm going to do a bunch of EMOMs, because if I force myself to get under the bar 10 times, I'm not going to go out there and not get under the bar.
Yeah.
So I think that was a really hard time. It was just those long plateaus, because I don't think I PR'd for like a year.
So how did you convince yourself to take a step back and do that, though? Because like some people will say, well, they know they have a problem with something, but they can't take that step back and say, this is what I need to do to get to where I want to be. So how did you make that bridge that gap between where you were at and where you wanted to be mentally?
I think it was just, I sat there and looked at what I wanted for the future. Was it that I wanted to just keep going to AO Series, American Open Final, and then maybe squeeze out getting to Nationals, or did I want to go and compete?
Right.
And the competitor in me was just like, no, we want to go compete. And I think leading up to, was it AO Series started the year after Florida for Anaheim?
Mm-hmm.
And so that whole year, I didn't go to any of the series because I just couldn't afford it at the time. And every time after one, I'd look at what the weights were. It's like, oh, I would have won. I'd go to the next one. It was like, oh, I would have won. Go to the next one. Yeah, I could have took second. And it just, at that point, I was like, man, I should be doing a lot better. And then got to Anaheim, bombed out, was like, okay, wait. I'm not that good. I need to be better. And it just pushed me to be better, that I kept looking. And I was like resting on the fact that like, oh, if I would have gone, I would have won,
right,
instead of like showing up to the American Open and actually performing.
Right. Okay. So kind of like, instead of saying what could have been, saying this is where I'm at now and this is what I want to do.
This is where I want to go. Okay. Yeah. That makes, and focusing my point on like, I want to be there.
Yeah.
This is where, these are the numbers I want to hit, and I'm going to push to hit them. And after I hit them, I'm going to push to hit another one.
Okay.
Like these are my goals. These are where I'm reaching. And kind of looking more towards what I want to do and where I want to be as an athlete than, oh, well, I could have done this if I did this.
Right, yeah. That makes sense.
I noticed that around that time, you also took a pretty big step back from your social media. Did that have anything to do with that, where you were just feeling like you were investing too much time in, you know, making posts? Or did you just say, well, it's like, well, I'm just doing this for me, so why does anybody else need to know? Did that have anything to do with that?
I mean, a lot of it was just, I was annoyed by like, oh, I need to record this set. Oh, I need to record this. That it hit the point where I was like, no, I just want to train. Like, if I get something on camera, cool. And I'll try to do it a little bit now so we can post it with you guys for the gym's post. But for the most part, it's like, I don't want to take the time to have to like run, set up my camera. We have such a small space that like everyone's worried about walking in front of lifters already, that now they're worried about walking in front of someone's phone.
Right.
So I think it just hit the point where I was just tired of trying to record myself, and felt like every time I'd set up my camera, it was a miss. I was like, oh, I missed it. Like, because I spent so much time worrying about this, I didn't even think about what I needed to do in my lift, and I missed it for whatever dumb reason.
So yeah. It kind of helps you stay focused.
And I'd rather you make a lift than record one, even though I've asked you to record one every now and then anyway. But yeah, so like that, having that focus and not paying so much attention to the phone really makes a difference.
Do you follow a lot of other people in your weight class to kind of keep up with what they're doing in training, or do you try not to worry about that?
I think I follow a few.
Mainly just trying to make sure that you're outlifting CrossFitters?
I think I follow a lot more CrossFitters than I do weightlifters, because I don't like when CrossFitters outlift me. Like, I think Jacob Hebner just hit a 270 clean, 270 pound clean, and I didn't like that at all.
Or clean?
I think he just, or no, 370 clean.
Oh, okay. I was like, I'm not that impressed by 270.
I'm pretty sure.
370 clean. There we go. Yeah, 370 clean, and he can't jerk it, but didn't like that he beat me.
Yeah, that's fair.
But not a lot of weightlifter. I think the few weightlifters I do follow either a lot heavier than I am or lighter than I am. I think there might be only one, which is Jesse from Colombia.
Oh, Lopez?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I follow him. He might be the only 81, and then Harrison Morris.
Well, of course. Yeah. So, that being said, who do you say if you had to pick a favorite lifter? It can be international. Well, we can do a USA and an international.
If you had a translator, you could pick any lifter. Who would you hang out with?
Man, I kind of started admiring Toshiki after Worlds just because he just seemed so unorthodox and like going out onto a national stage and be like, yeah, I'm going to lift in something that no one else is lifting in. I mean, be cool to pick his brain and listen to him talk. And then it'd be cool to hear Harrison Morris's story just because I remember seeing him at Anaheim. And then seeing him, I think, in Vegas, and he got thick. He just has been bulking, and I would love to be like, dude, what are you doing? Besides just being an 18-year-old with a lot of hormones, what are you doing? Like,
right.
Am I doing anything different than you're doing? Like, this is, it's pretty amazing.
What do I gotta eat?
Yeah.
All right, so I think we'll caption that off, the weightlifting portion. We always try to bring up some interesting conversations with some either philosophy or some thought experience experiments. So what did you have in store for Tyler Grayson?
So what we've got today is, so there's a concept called the paradox of choice, right? So this is essentially that if you have the choice between using a shopping example, if you go to a store and there are 15 kinds of salad dressing, or you go to a store and there are 3, the level of satisfaction with the choice that you make goes down with the number of other options that you have. So the more freedom to choose that you have, the less satisfied you are with any one choice. So, if there was a zombie apocalypse, and the only option you had every day was find food and survive, and your choices of what job do I have, what kind of car do I need, what do I wear today, what does this person think, if all of those things were eliminated, but the world was kind of a harsh place, do you think there's room that people might actually be happier in some strange way if it all fell apart?
I mean, it depends on how long the zombie apocalypse has been going. The ones that are, like, if it's the beginning, nobody's happy. But as soon as people are, like, the ones that can't make it or can't survive have kind of been turned into zombies, and you get to the later ends of the zombie apocalypse where, like, people are just in their ways, they're probably pretty happy. They're probably not too upset that, like, okay, they just have accepted this as life and they just keep going. So I feel like the beginning stages, nobody's happy. Yeah. Later stages, you get more of that happiness because you're just like, oh, cool, yeah, I went and got food. This was a good day.
Like I got to eat an old can of beans.
Where all of us are like, oh, man, I got to go to Walmart right now. This is horrible. I don't want to go. Maybe I'll do that tomorrow. I'll just eat cereal tonight. We'll be fine.
Well, yeah, because it's. I wonder what the change is. Because, I mean, you can kind of look at this as, you know, if you look at traditional hunter-gatherer societies, the amount of time that hunter-gatherers actually spend working is really minimal. Those guys do about 20 hours a week of food gathering, and the rest of the time they just kind of hang out and they tell stories and they make jokes or they play around. And so adding all of these kind of conveniences, you know, just it does give you the freedom to be anything that you want and do anything that you want. But the fact that there are so many things that you can choose, I think, makes people a little bit more anxious. And if, you know, it's how much, how do you think we can, like, simplify our day-to-day things? Like, what are, like, do you think that there's a way to kind of simplify the amount of choices in your day so that you're not really struck with that anxiety of, like, I could do whatever I want today, And that in itself is kind of terrifying. Yeah. So what if I make the wrong decision?
That paralysis by analysis thing, where it's just like you have so many options, you're paralyzed because you don't know which one to pick, because they could all be great, but then they could all be bad. You just don't know which one you're going to end up with.
Yeah, that's rough. I try to keep it simple. Keep all the hard decisions out.
is there something you do to simplify, like even picking your clothes out for what you're going to work out in? Is it just like grab and go, or
grab
is
and
it
go.
Just like this has to match with this? This has to go with this.
I mean, you guys can all talk to my fiance. I don't match ever.
I think she accused you of wanting to wear a pink suit to your wedding.
Yeah, she got mad at that joke. She didn't like that one. But I grab and go for clothes. I try to meal prep and keep it the same thing every day, because if I have to sit there and choose, it just stresses me out. Because now I'm like, okay, well, does this have what I need to perform today, and does this not? I think just making your life simpler, taking out those choices, it makes things easier.
Yeah, you know, that's something that a lot of those, I guess, I don't know what they call themselves, like efficiency experts say. So like when people are CEOs and things like that, mm-hmm. they want to diminish the amount of decision making that they have to do on extraneous stuff. So they'll just simplify their wardrobe, they'll simplify what they eat, they'll simplify their routine as much as possible to keep all their decision making processes focused on what's important. So it sounds like you've already implemented some of that in your life too. Just grab and go, meal prep, make sure that you keep things as simple as possible.
I mean, isn't it most CEOs don't wear suits? They wear the same t-shirt and jeans every day?
Most of them, yeah. A lot of them do. Yeah, because like you're constantly having to use all that brain power on all these other things. And if it was a zombie apocalypse, you're not going to decide. It's like, ooh, should I carry my .38 today or my crossbow? Or, you know, no, you're just going to grab one thing, stick with it, and make it work.
It's always Ninja Sword.
Ninja Sword is good. You never run out of ammo.
Yeah.
You never run out of ammo.
It's very true.
You know, any zombie apocalypse scenario is a testament to how bad we are at building things, like walls and fences. It's just like how much time do we spend building things to keep people out of stuff, and when a zombie apocalypse happens, it doesn't keep anybody out of anything.
Well, so this brings me to a secondary secondary question. Now, we're all well versed in zombie fiction movies. It's been a plethora for like the last 10 years. So when somebody becomes a zombie, it's not like their teeth get sharper. So if the average person can't bite through a denim jacket, how are these zombies biting through people's clothes? Like, yeah. Exposed skin, sure, you can get a nasty bite from a person.
Sure.
But it's not like your jaw strength is going to go up because you've been dead for 6 weeks. How are these zombies biting through denim jackets? I'm upset about this.
Have you not had any denim in the past 10 years? It's all crap. Falls apart in a year.
Well, yeah, but could you bite through it? Wear and tear, fine, but like an incident, like biting through a leather jacket just seems like it.
But you could go to like a motorcycle store and just get like the whole getup and you're zombie proof.
Yeah, I just don't understand why people are still wearing t-shirts in these scenarios.
Because it's hot outside and you gotta show some cleavage, Grayson.
That's true, you gotta sell the show.
Yeah, they're not. Going for, you know, safety. It's all about fashion still in most zombie apocalypses.
Yeah, if there's a zombie apocalypse, I'm going to go to the motorcycle outfit store and get assless chaps and just walk around with those on.
Chaps are inherently assless.
Well, then, that's less material that's got to cover. No, but seriously, like, I would just have, like, a whole leather suit with a helmet, and I would be zombie-proof.
And then your helmet's a weapon. You can just headbutt all the zombies. See? Good to go.
Exactly.
I think another on the happiness and choice front in the zombie apocalypse is that idea of contrast, right? Where when things are life really is brutish and short, you're really going to appreciate the times that it's not, you know? So that contrast of how bad things usually are probably means that those like relationships you do have like just kind of feel a lot different than, like, your average interaction with a convenience store clerk. Like, I imagine that if you're, you know, it's rare that you have that moment of quiet, like, that's got to be, like, the best feeling. coming out of just a horrible, horrible scenario.
You mean like surviving something?
Yeah, you know, like it, like there's got to be that, you know, that quiet after the attack, you know, when you've, you know, re-solidified everything and you've, you know, managed to maintain your farm or whatever. You know, there's got to be like a quality to that survival experience that is, you know, above and beyond what we tend to experience on a day-to-day. Like, that's got to be a really interesting
well, I would sensation. Imagine it's like surviving a set of tens, back squats. You're just happy you got through it. Then you sit there and you're just breathing and focusing on not dying.
Well, then
everything's okay.
Every day is a stress relief. Like, someone makes you mad, you just go to the wall and start stabbing some zombies. You feel a little better.
That's true.
I mean, it's you like, get all your aggression out. You're probably not very, very upset after a full-blown zombie breakthrough. You're just like, all right, yeah, just slice 20 zombie heads. Hey, we could sit down and chat. I'm not very angry anymore.
Like, yeah, I've never slept better in my life. I'm exhausted from killing all these zombies. Yeah, I think that kind of covers the plethora of choices we have. Maybe they're making us less happy. I don't know.
Zombies are or choices?
Choices.
A little bit of both. Maybe
a little bit of both. You have to choose zombies, then you start getting into a
I mean,
whole
when you
gotta
choose your zombie shows, it's very stressful. It's taking too much time. They just need one zombie show that doesn't suck.
Which one is your favorite?
I mean, I liked The Walking Dead in the beginning. And then as soon as they got to the prison, it just went down and I stopped watching. I think I watched until they got to the cannibals, and I was super excited because I was like, ooh, cannibals. And then there
I
was nothing.
One.
Yeah, they
was,
ended that pretty quick.
Yeah, they like built up these really bad cannibals and then killed them all in like one episode. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh yeah, this was supposed to be like a really long bad guy, and you guys just ruined it. But then I think while I was watching that, I ended up watching World War Z, and I just sat there and I was like, man, these guys on The Walking Dead are just, they're, what's wrong with them? These zombies just slightly stagger towards them and they're having trouble surviving. The ones in World War Z could like sprint superhuman speed and make like giant zombie walls to climb up and over things.
That's yeah, pretty terrifying.
I think 28 Days Later is still one of my favorite zombie apocalypse movies. That one's pretty solid. And see, at the end of that movie, he's out in the country, living in a cottage. They're having a good time. This probably feels way better than his dead-end job. You just have to survive the horror of the zombie horde, and maybe you can find peace.
Well, so what's funny about World War Z is that the movie and the book don't have anything to do with each other, mm-hmm. really. But in the book, the most sought-after people were the people that could redo infrastructure. So, like, construction workers, plumbers, electricians. Like, they weren't looking for anybody that could program computers or anything. It was like, can you fix my toilet? And those were the people that were just, like, the pinnacle of society. It's like, because you can help make things good again.
Well, that's exactly it, because it would entirely flip the script on what we've currently value in the society, which is kind of intellectual work and property and, like, yeah. you know, intellectual property. But the second that kicked off, it would be an inversion where the plumbers would be the ruling class.
Yeah. Because if I have to poop outside in the cold, then that sucks.
You're going to get attacked by a zombie out there anyway.
Yeah, you're
going to
get attacked by a zombie. With my assless chaps.
It All does right. make it convenient, though, the no ass.
All right, so that concludes the episode for today. It's episode 21. We would like to thank Tyler for joining us in some of our weird conversations. Is there anything you want to add?
Like, yeah, any,
to tell
any
folks,
final
or
words of advice for
good,
our
bad, ugly.
Listeners?
just keep moving forward. That's all you can do.
Just keep swimming. Like
just
Nori.
Keep swimming. In everything you're doing in life, whatever you're pursuing, just keep swimming.
All right, take it easy, guys. We'll catch you next week.
All right, y'all. Happy lifting.